demon, are you?
You are freaking me!
Are they slow moving, Chief?
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second edition of the Planet of Terror podcast. I am your host, Cortez the Killer. I am joined tonight by a very special guest, writer-director Greg Holcrew of the fantastic independent horror feature, Dawning. Welcome, Greg.
Thanks for having me.
And so for our folks listening, it's a film that featured for what must be like the last year and a half now. And it's a fantastic independent horror film. It made my top 10 list of this past year, along with a lot of other bloggers. And for those of you that may not have heard about the film before, just to kind of give a little bit of a brief synopsis, the film takes place in a northern Minnesota cabin where a family has kind of come together to reconnect some broken bonds, a brother and a sister, and a father and stepmother. That's my dog, by the way.
A boxer.
Ozzy, say hello to everyone. This is live. This is live, so I can't stop my dog from wanting to play.
No, I mean, that's almost impossible.
I just can't. Like, he just wants to go, and you can't really say no to a 70-pound boxer that wants to play. Anyway, so it features this family that's trying to get to and reconnect bonds, and what kind of starts off with good intentions really cuts to within the first quarter of the film, a traumatic event happening with the family where the family dog is found dead. And then from there, it's pretty much chaos from the word go. There's a stranger that appears within the home, and they take in this bloody stranger, and he makes claims of something out in the woods, something that's out after him, and that has killed his girlfriend. And for much of the remainder of the film, a lot is preyed upon the mind of the viewer, where you're trying to figure out exactly what's going on. Is there a monster outside? Is it an alien? You know, we kind of, as a viewer, are trying to affix some sort of a presence manifesting within this on-screen terror and fear that our folks are witnessing and experiencing. And to that end, towards the end, you start to realize that there's something else going on within the film itself. Not too much to give too much away to the film itself. It leaves a lot open to the imagination, and that's where I think the main effect is within the film itself. That it really relies on the mind of the viewer to kind of project himself and kind of come up with kind of his own conclusion on what's going on. And yeah, so that's where I find the greatness of the film lies, is the fact that the greatest fear is what you make up within your own mind as the viewer. Is that an apt description there, Greg?
Yeah, man, I think you're exactly right. I mean, especially, you know, specifically the last thing you said, obviously the first part was more of a synopsis, but the last part about there being really no greater fear than what someone kind of comes up with in their head, which was really one of the main driving kind of, I guess, picking up the film, or at least the concept.
And the amazing thing that I found about it, too, after subsequent viewings, is like you spend so much time as a viewer trying to figure it out. And, you know, in your mind, you're trying to pin it to something, right? You just naturally, as a film goer and, you know, folks that, you know, read stories or watch film, you want to try to place it, like, on something. You know, it's this, or it's that, you know. And if you can't put I guess that ascribe it to some sort of physical element or figure, I think that's a normal part of human nature to do that.
Yeah.
And what I found was really interesting in the film and subsequent viewings is you spend so much time doing that within the film as the watcher, and like then you watch it again and you start to catch on the other things that go on in the film too, like a lot of additional dialogue that goes on that kind of clues you into what else might be going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the when Danny says, "Did you see it?" towards the end.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. That kind of. But at this by this point, you're starting to realize that it's there's maybe not a physical manifestation there of anything. There might be something greater out there that's after them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, that was one of the trickiest parts with the film is that, you know, it was hard because, I mean, I was trying to give people enough information where obviously, you know, you're hoping you can get the audience through the film, but at the same time, you know, you don't want to kind of corner yourself into anything really giving them, like, I guess almost not a reality, but a logic, you know, is, you know, and that was one thing that Mike Colin, the co-editor, and I really focused on right away when we did the first cut was just anything that started to make you put a logical explanation together, we got rid of it because we knew there wasn't going to be no logical resolution. So therefore, we really had to kind of get out just, you know, whether it was a line of dialogue, whether it was a scene, you know, whatever it might have been, just anything that kind of just, I guess, just lended itself to too much of a reality. And so, but that was, yeah, that was tricky. So, I mean, I'm very glad that you liked that part of the film, because I think that's one of the hardest things for, you know, for audiences is that aspect.
Is that been like the main criticism that's been leveled on the film? That there's definitely like from my take of just reading other folks' reaction, and I just know talking from you and interacting with you, is there's definitely like it seems like there's a clear divide, one way or another.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting actually because I used to be really concerned that an audience wouldn't necessarily just like the fact that there was something going on that they don't see, but that seems to not be as big a problem as I think really the most probably divisive part in the film is probably the ending and then probably just the pacing of it. You know, for those who accept the pacing of it and are willing to, you know, kind of go with it and let it slowly take over, I don't think they're having as much of a problem, and, you know, they're accepting the film, and, you know, obviously those who aren't, you know, those the paced or what have you, I mean, they're, you know, I can't really win them over anyway, but I think really the ending is pretty divisive, and I understand why, but at the same time, because of what you had mentioned before, where, you know, we don't really have this physical creature, or there's not this kind of this thing that they're fighting. So it was hard to kind of have a climax and a concrete resolution with that because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't Jaws where we knew that the end of the film was inevitably it's going to come down, you know, to Roy Scheider and the shark, you know, and just like any movie, it's going to come down to the protagonist and the thing that they're fighting and, you know, and hopefully they're stronger, you know, and they win. And I just, you know, for me, it was like, how do you end something where I don't know and the actors don't know and the audience doesn't know? Like, we don't even know what's really going on. And so it was really hard to find an ending. So I guess, yeah, at the end of the day, I would say that that's probably the most divisive for the audience.
In all honesty, I thought it was, like, the best way to end it. Like, I think you know, Aurora, who's played by Najera Townsend, I think she kind of like becomes like aware and kind of resigned to the fact that this is her fate. You know, there's no way out.
Yeah, exactly, and that.
So I thought it was perfect. I left it with, you know, not only my jaw hanging on the floor, but as like, okay, I feel comfortable with that because like it's just and I think for her character, I think she. Everybody else has started realizing what's going on in their own way, but her, this is her moment, and it's just, in a way, her dawning, right, of her realization of what her fate is.
Yeah, exactly, and like almost you know, without getting into it, you know, maybe intellectualizing it too much, but it's, you know, it's a moment of, you know, the realization of death and the fact that she can't escape, you know, her family and her home, and she can't escape those things from the past, and mostly because they weren't able to be dealt with because of the film. So yeah, and, you know, and part of the whole idea of this thing that they're fighting is kind of death. Like, I remember this one woman had asked me, you know, well, you know, like, is it death itself, you know? And if it's death, you know, because we've seen movies where there's this kind of manifestation of death or whatever, there's this idea of what that means if death were to visit you or knock on your door. You know, we've seen that film a few times. And
right.
For me, it was more of the concept of death less than, you know, manifestation of death. You know, we know how people die. I mean, you get cancer, you know, however you die. But I just like the idea that still at the end of the day, we do question why we die and we question where we go, and there's no answer to it. And you still go through a grieving process, and it still feels very unknown. And ultimately, I think a lot of people are fighting death all the way to the end instead of kind of accepting it. And so Aurora's moment, you know, too, is just kind of a moment of acceptance that, you know, everyone dies, including the people in her family and including herself, you know.
Right, so, right.
So, yeah.
So one thing you touched upon, and I know within the initial interview that we did for the blog a while back, so the first treatment of the film actually had a physical monster. Is that correct?
Yeah, when I shot it in 2000, there was a creature, but you never saw it. But it was a physical creature.
You broke up for a minute there. Was it
2004.
Okay.
When we had shot a black and white version, there were multiple creatures, but you never saw them. But you could, you know, that you could hear them, you know, scratching and doing stuff. Like, you knew that it was it was underneath the cab and all that kind of stuff. People were attacked. And then in 2006, when we had raised money to reshoot it, we actually did have a creature made that really just kind of burst the whole bubble of the film, like the whole shooting, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Did it just look ridiculous, or this isn't gonna fly or anything?
You know, it looked all right. Like, I mean, the guy who created it is extremely talented, but you know, it's just one of those things again that I think that, you know, the way that I talked after, you know, we were just kind of going through everything, you know, in the 2006 shoot, the creature didn't come into play until, you know, about midway through the film, when you'd start to maybe see shadows or silhouettes, or maybe it moves by a window. And so it wasn't on set for a while, and everything leading up to that, it was fascinating how everyone's imagination would kind of play on them, you know, and the actors were able to imagine what, you know, was going on, and they didn't know. But then once the creature showed up, it like burst everyone's bubble, and all of a sudden there was this actual physical manifestation, and we knew what it was. And then it was kind of like, well, you know, that's not scary, or all you got to do is shoot that thing. You know, it's like, you know, you figure out how to kill it really quick. You know, it's,
yeah,
you know, I'm no big deal. I mean, zombies come into my place right now. I know how to kill them. I've seen enough. You know? So yeah, we did have one.
What did it look like?
But it was like, you know what, at the end of the day, the a cross between, it was like, what the hell, Goober? What's the ghost name in Ghostbusters?
Slimer.
Slimer, there we go. It was like Slimer with a penis for a tail.
Wow.
For real.
Did it float in the air?
It didn't have, it was kind of a puppetry thing, so we had to like move it as if it kind of had legs, you know. And I mean, not only that, but man, I was like, I'm never shooting with puppets.
I'm glad you ditched that. that would have been a failure on every level. Like, you know, you build up the suspense, and then all of a sudden midway through you like reveal this monster, like, yeah.
That's what I mean. That, and you know what? It was exactly what my problem was with so many films. Like, for instance, Jeepers Creepers, right?
Yeah.
Actually, the first like half hour of that movie, I just loved it. The relationship between the brother and sister, and just what was going on. And then all of a sudden, when they showed that wing thing, I was like, You gotta be kidding me. Like, what is this thing?
Yeah.
I don't buy it.
No, yeah, I liked it for what it was.
I did too. I mean, I liked the film, but it was, I just felt like, I don't know, maybe they could have kept pushing the not seeing what this thing was, even if they reveal it at the end, you know, I guess. I don't know. I'm torn. But anyway, so.
Well, I'm glad you didn't go with the that monster route. Yeah, that.
Thanks, man. It was very evident once I looked at the dailies.
But then, so then we talk about, like, so you talk about then, like, the other point of criticism is, like, the slow-moving aspect of the film. And for that, that's the one aspect I did enjoy. It was definitely a slow-burn type of film. Yeah. And to me, the most effective horror films of the last few years is, like, a return to a traditional build of atmosphere and suspense. And I think it's really a dead practice right now within horror films, especially with this trend of remakes and mainstream Hollywood releases, where it's you know, that typical hack and slash, and then, you know, the constant action for the ADD riddled crowd.
Yeah.
Do you think that has to come in to play at some point with that criticism that folks are used to this?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, especially with, I think on the distribution end, in terms, I guess, of where I'm finding frustration on their end is that, you know, they've seemingly kind of decided that that's also just what people want. So I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe that is only what people want. Maybe it's not. You know, sometimes it's not even up to the people. It's hard for me to know, you know, whether it's an audience thing or not. You know, and there's definitely, of course, people who have a problem with it. But I guess at the end of the day, you know, for me, the most important thing was having a well-crafted film, because I think you're exactly right about a lot of the films nowadays, whether it's remakes or whatever. They just seem to lack a craft of some of the older films, and, you know, just even in just little things, you know, just from the way things are framed and what's in the frame. And, yeah, I feel like that's definitely lacking. And so I don't know. I mean, it's such a weird mix, you know, of the distributors and audiences, and then there's your pacing. And so it's just so hard to really know what the problem is, you know, because at the end of the day, most of the distributors just go, we need names.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. Like, I was going to talk about that a little bit later, but we'll flip flop conversation wise here. So, in talking about, so this is so for our listeners here, to kind of bring you up to speed here on a little bit of history of the film. So you've played about what, 20 film festivals now? More than that now?
We played 19 festivals, and then we've probably screened, you know, if you take like All Things Horror, how they do the monthly film.
Yeah, those guys have been awesome.
Yeah, they do a great job. So, like, if you take kind of those little things into consideration as well, we've probably had 25 to 30 screenings since April of 2009.
And multiple awards.
Yeah, we won 4 awards. Won Best Picture at Rhode Island Horror Festival, Screenplay and Audience Award at Solstice, and then we got a Silver Race Award from the Los Angeles or Las Vegas, which is outstanding achievement in filmmaking. And then, you know, we've gotten a lot of nominations too, which has been great. You know, at the Terror Film Festival, we had 11 Claw Award nominations. So yeah, I mean, plus we've had some success in non-horror festivals, which has been nice. So it kind of seems like, you know, there are horror fans and you know, programmers and different people who are enjoying the film, and even people outside the genre. So it's been nice, yeah.
I mean, I keep pitching to people as the best horror film you haven't seen yet, just because of the gamut of stuff that you've gone through. So, I mean, to kind of back up a little bit, like, so when did you kind of first start hitting hard, like, the you know, pitching to distribution companies?
We really. Let's see. I mean, I guess the main thing is, like, you know, as we started, you know, we were hit up by, I think, we're really you know, pretty low grade, pretty low end. You could just tell by their content and their contracts. And then, and that was, you know, in 2009 when we first started our festival run.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we got contacted by various producers, reps, and a few sales agents. And so we ended up, finally, after going through all that, ended up going into Circus Road Films. And so right now they are serving as our producers reps. And so they're basically the company that takes our film and approaches the distributors, and they kind of break it up into tiers. And so there's a tier one group, which would be like your Lionsgate and your Paramount, Warner Brothers, all the big ones. And then you have tier two. And so they basically approach those companies. And so right now we've been with them for, I'd say about three and a half months, maybe 4 months. And so right now we're on the tier two companies, all the companies. And so we're waiting on the rest of the companies. And then after that, I guess I'm not sure what happens. That's when I just start slinging DVDs, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, so to talk about a little bit, like, so I know, and I followed your progress, you know, both in email communications and on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And you've certainly been put through the ringer, and I've heard the whole gamut of excuses of why and or actually why not. Talk about that process a little bit. I mean, you at a certain point, like I think you've kind of taken it in stride, and you kind of run from being angry to finding some humor in it. Talk a little bit about everything that you've kind of experienced.
Yeah, I mean, it's a roller coaster. I mean, you know, on one hand, you know, you have to laugh about it, because it almost kind of seems absurd, you know, because you're sitting there going, man, I've been in 19 festivals, and there's like, we've got almost 20 reviews that are positive, and yet you still have a company that writes you and says, we don't think the critics would like it. And you're kind of going, well, I don't know. I mean, maybe they would like other critics, you know, like it, or whatever you consider a critic, I guess. But
yeah.
So that's been frustrating. And
are they talking from like the mainstream perspective? So like your
Like maybe your Roger Ebert or something wouldn't like it. Although I would beg to differ. I think Roger Ebert would actually really appreciate it.
That's what I was going to say. Like,
you know, I'm convinced of that, but I can't, you know, convince
these. I mean, shit, if he liked The Right, I mean, there's he's got to like this. I haven't seen it yet, but, I mean, I heard The Right's pretty decent. But from what I understand, it's a fairly straightforward exorcism-type film. So with Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah.
And I guess that's your star power there, and you don't have that. You don't have that, but your film's a lot more cerebral and a lot more thought-provoking.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and I mean, you know, obviously, you know, I knew, you know, I wasn't under any delusion that, you know, I was going to be the, you know, quote-unquote next Blair Witch or Open Water paranormal or,
yeah,
you know, anything like that. And so on that hand, I you know, I've never been disappointed really with the tier one companies turning me down and saying we need names. I mean, I understand, you know, that's what those companies do. And it's been more disappointing, I think, with the tier two companies and the lower ones you know, where, you know, I look at some of the films that they're releasing and honestly, at the end of the day, the only thing that I can think is they're releasing those films because there's literally just more blood and some nudity in them. You know, I mean, not to toot my own horn or whatever, but I mean, I'm, you know, compared to some of those other films that these companies release, and I'm just like, wow, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, these movies are terrible. But I guess that's why I'm not a businessman and I don't run a distribution company. I'm sure I'd make all the wrong decisions, you know, I don't know.
I think that's my main bone of contention with horror right now. It definitely seems for a lot of the stuff that's being released, it's serving the lowest common denominator, and especially with a lot of the Hollywood stuff. I mean, did you know that the number one movie in America last week was The Roommate?
Was it really?
Have you seen previews for it?
I don't even know. What is that?
I liked it better when it was called Single White Female.
Oh, really?
It's exactly the same thing. I mean, it's a college girl who has a roommate that moves in with her. She becomes completely obsessed with her, wants to take over her life, becomes her. And from what I hear and from reviews that I've read, very lackluster kills. There's no real justification for how she became kind of psycho crazy. It's total candy-coated for the Twilight tween crowd, whatever type of horror film. And it opened with, like, I think it was like $15 million last week, which is, like, mind-boggling.
Yeah, you know, that. I mean, that's the thing. You know, you keep having kids coming up, and it's easy to cater to the 15, 16-year-old, you know, boy and girl, and they just want to go to the theater. I mean, they're not, you know, that's the thing. They're not even watching the film anyway. You know, they're making out or whatever they're doing. You know, they don't care. I mean, you know, I get it. I did the same thing when I was in eighth grade. I probably gave way too much money to, like, movies like The Guardian. but I mean, you know, it's, but yeah, it's, I don't know. It's not even just horror, you know, it's really film in general. It's like right. Independent film, even it, you know, I've the Lagoon Cinema down the street from me in the Uptown. They're both Landmark, you know, Landmark owns tons of theaters, obviously, and they bring the indie films there. And,
yep.
You know, and it's, I don't know. I honestly, I think it's ever since Pulp Fiction, when Pulp Fiction made like $100 million, and suddenly like independent film became an actual like brand that you marketed a certain way, and you had to have certain, almost like a genre, like you had to have certain things to be independent. And, you know, you look at the last year and look at the posters, you know, and there's animation a lot in posters and in the background, even if the movie doesn't have anything to do with it, like, it's like a symbol of independent, you know, quirky characters, witty dialogue, and
yeah.
And I just think it's disappointing in general just how everything gets so branded, because that's the only way that anyone understands how to market.
Yeah.
Because they don't trust that people will make their, you know, a smart decision, or, you know, word of mouth. And God, remember when Night of the Living Dead, you know, look at, I mean, not that we were even alive, but I mean, that came out, you know, in a drive-in, and then all of a sudden it was like, hey man, you know, we want that movie at our drive-in, and, you know, people contacted, and it was just this nice word of mouth thing. And now that's manufactured, like Paranormal Activity. That's a manufactured, we want you to show up in our city. You know,
right.
It was already bought and being pushed out by, you know, Paramount, and they set up this website, and everyone feels like they have that same kind of, I'm finding an underground film and I'm helping it come to my city, but it's all manufactured. And that's the unfortunate part, is like, they've even manufactured the grassroots aspect of it, you know.
Right.
It's a strange thing.
It is, very much so. So you bring you touch on an interesting thing. So the films that are kind of branded with that, and, you know, they're backed by major studios, but they label themselves as independent. Do you think it takes away from true artists such as yourself and other people that are true independent? Like, you know, you put every last nickel, dime, and quarter into what you're making, and, like, you really are doing grassroots. You know, you're reaching out to bloggers, you're reaching out, and you're pitching yourself, you're pitching your film to folks. But you don't have that same budget.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there's been a lot of talk of, you know, about that on various panels and whatnot, like Filmmaker Magazine, where, you know, a lot of people say, like, the independent filmmaker today, you know, has to really see their film from, you know, conception through, you know, the shooting, through the post-production, all the, potentially even the actual releasing of the film. And I think it's, you know, because of what most people think is independent, it does kind of cloud the water. And so I think it's harder for people to really know what, in my opinion, I guess, is true independent cinema. I mean, technically speaking, you know, the Coen brothers get their, you know, their financing from, you know, wherever, but, you know, they're going to get their film released through Paramount or whatever company is going to release it, Warner, what have you. And so, you know, Kevin Smith premiering his movie at Sundance, you know, things like that. You know, yeah, I think it just, what it does is it clouds the water for people to really kind of latch on to what the independent movement really is nowadays.
Right.
And, you know, because it was that at one point. I mean, Sundance was more of that. Not that they still didn't have their films with stuff, but it pushed that stuff a little bit more, and it'd be nice to have a festival that did that again.
Yep. Definitely. So kind of talking again about district stuff. Have you looked into the other, like, I guess, mediums? I heard like Amazon's got like a streaming feature now, and things like IndieFlix.
Yeah, I think we'll end up going. I'm assuming anyway that we'll end up pursuing all of those routes once. Hopefully not, but once the tier two companies, if they decline. Obviously, if we, you know, can get an offer from one of those guys, then we'll go with them. But we'll see, you know, what happens. But yeah, we've looked at nothing too much at this point. Just we want to wait and let the other companies play out before any major decisions are made.
Gotcha.
Because once you put it out there, like, you know, I mean, that's the weird thing too. You know, that's one of the problems I've run into is, you know, I was talking with executive over at New Line, you know, who was like, God, you know, I wish I would have seen this film before it, you know, was in any festivals. You know, and the whole reason he even saw my movie was because I was in festivals, and that's how I got in contact with him. But it's a really weird thing. You know, you got to, you know, if it plays at too many festivals, it's kind of a, you know, kind of a strike against you.
Yeah, that's a weird thing too. Yeah, I did want to ask about that because that was a really interesting point that somebody had made. So I guess it's attributed to somebody at New Line that they said, like, I mean, that's just a mind-boggling thing to me. It's like, I mean, it's still not in a mass release. It's still limited. And so outside of the people within that festival, like, who else would have seen it? So it. And you know, I think too, like, the other part of that, comment, correct me if I'm wrong, is like he kind of wanted to discover it for himself.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, that's what it is. Like, because on one hand, you're exactly right, where you're going, well, you know, really no one's seen it. I mean, even with these festivals, even with 19 festivals and 25 screenings, you know, you're looking at, you know, maybe a few thousand tops. I mean, absolutely tops that have seen it. And, but a lot of it is discovery. A lot of it is the ego of the discovery, of being the person who discovered it. A lot of it is, before the film even gets put out there, they want to take it and maybe they, you know, cause I know other filmmakers where this is, I was talking to where he took their film and said, okay, you know, you need to, you know, reshoot this scene or add some footage here. You know, maybe we can re-edit it and there's some stuff. And they went back and they added some more footage and they shot it and, you know, ended up being able to sell the film. And that's a lot of the reason that they like to get a hold of it early as well. And so but you know, how the hell do you get a movie to somebody?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yes. But at the same time, what's nice is that I did meet him. I do know the guy. And so when I do make another film, I could send him an early rough cut. I can send him early whatever, and who knows? You know, maybe they'll like that one. anyway.
Yeah.
So.
All right. So let's move away a little bit from the doom and gloom and kind of crappiness that can be the distribution and putting yourself out there type of efforts. So tell me a little bit what you're working on right now. I know we've kind of been back and forth a little bit on kind of what you're working on, but like, what are you excited about?
Well, you know, that's the thing. The doom and gloom, the good part of it is, you know, if you use it the right way, it can energize you a little bit. And so
absolutely.
I'm trying to use it, you know, to write some stuff. I mean, I know I talked to you a little bit about Snowblind.
Yes. Can we talk about that at all or no?
Yeah. You know, I actually started semi taking it in a different direction, which it would be interesting to.
Yeah.
For lack of a better way, because I hate when people try to, you know, sometimes the only way you can explain a movie is to compare it to another one or whatever.
So for our, if I may interject.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
So for our listeners here, I was extremely humbled and like really excited that Greg reached out to me a couple months ago to provide feedback on a script that he had written in between. I think you were still working on editing Dawning. Is that right?
Yeah, just finishing up the sound mix, adding the score by Nathaniel Levese into it.
So at a high level, the script is about kind of like a storm of the century type of scenario where two sets of couples are stranded out in the middle of the snow. Yeah. Not only do they have to deal with the elements, but there's a supernatural force at work, if you will. I won't get into too much other than that, but it was phenomenal. It left me at the end of that reading. I was like, wow, this is a really great concept. So I'm hoping that is your my own selfish reasons, of course.
Yeah.
your next project.
Trying to get it rolling. I think we can do it pretty cheap. Using a warehouse and especially with so much of the film taking place in the car.
I was hoping you'd be out like in the middle of like a northern Minnesota like crazy snowstorm, and you'd be out there filming with like your Han Solo
I'll be sleeping in tauntauns.
Exactly.
Yeah, we'll all be sleeping in tauntauns, staying warm and just waiting. You know, that's the thing, you know, imagine just sitting there having to wait for a storm to hit until you shoot. what a terrible day that would be. Who knows how long you'd wait?
What's it like right now in Minnesota?
It's cold as hell, but it is officially warming up, and I think tomorrow we'll be out of the single digits, probably from here on out.
Holy shit. So I have no concept of that. So I was Cali born and raised, and so I've been out in Dallas now for 5 years, and we just got through like the worst winter storm we've ever had.
Where
with a wind chill factor, we had like minus one or minus two or something like that.
Cold, man.
Yeah, it was pretty brutal, and people flip a shit out here if they have like 2 or 3 inches of snow.
Oh yeah, that's not normal for down there.
It's crazy.
I know we've got. I mean, I don't even know how many inches we've got. It's at some point you just go, all right, there's a lot of snow. Just, you can't even keep track of it anymore.
Wow. I don't know if I could ever get used to that. I mean, do you just become like numb to the cold after a while and just like, eh, whatever?
You know, the key is just bundling up.
Yeah.
It's just hat and scarf. Oh, man, scarf. Too many people do not utilize the scarf.
The scarf is key.
You know, and you want to have some warm, you just got to dress for it. I mean, like, honestly, as soon as it gets cold here, I mean this sincerely, long johns do not come off me until spring.
That's awesome.
Everything is worn over long johns.
So back to projects. So Snowblind, yeah. You think you can maybe make it in a warehouse? Is that the so I saw your recent Facebook status update. Was that what you got inspired by to write a little bit, or is this maybe something else?
Yeah, I ripped through a lot of pages today, actually. It's pretty good. I've been kind of working with a guy. He's been helping me, I guess, focus a little bit, sitting down, kind of chatting. It's good for me. We've done it. So I ripped through 22 pages today. So things are actually looking pretty good. We got it all structured out. We had a big 11-hour marathon the other day.
Nice.
It'll be, I won't get into it too much, but you saw Frozen. What did you think of Frozen?
Frozen, I thought it was great. I thought it was, the thing I liked about it is, like, the characters seem, Adam Green, the filmmaker, so he kind of arrived on the scene, so to speak, with, I think Hatchet came out in 2002?
I forgot he did that.
Yeah, and so it was like it was kind of billed as like this return to American horror. And I watched it. It was okay. It had some decent scenes, but I mean, it's your run of the mill slasher film. It's something that's been done 1,000 times over. And I'm a huge fan of slasher films. I think they're, to me, a slasher film is it's a good escape. You know, after a grueling beat down type of horror film, I want to see something funny, goofy, and over the top.
Oh yeah, a couple of my favorite horror films of all time. I mean, are slasher films: Halloween, Psycho, Texas Chainsaw.
Yeah, I even like the stuff from the 80s that are just so ridiculous and stupid and campy.
Oh, they're just I understand. Believe me, I understand.
So, but when I saw Hatchet, it felt like those types of films, but it just didn't, for me, it just didn't really deliver. It didn't have the same sort of hokey and funny dialogue and I don't know. It looked like it reminded me of Star Wars Episode I. It looked like Star Wars, but it didn't really feel like Star Wars.
Yeah.
So, he's from what I understand, like a really good guy and a humble filmmaker and really like a engaging, loves his fans and a good all around dude. So when Frozen came out, I was actually excited about it because of the fact that it was a more of a turn to something serious. The thing that I enjoyed about it was the fact that the characters felt a little bit more relatable. They didn't feel as superficial.
Yeah.
So when shit went down, so to speak, and I was pulling on my nerd heartstrings with the Star Wars references. but when stuff started going down, I was like, wow, this sucks. and it was a terrible situation. Like, I didn't know how it would play out. I'm like, how would they make this like an entire film of these kids like stranded on a ski lift? But I tell you, at the end of that, I was like, wow, I'm not going skiing anytime soon. Not that I've ever been, but still.
Yeah. you haven't been in a whole lot of snow, so.
Right.
But yeah, I guess I would say, again, without any, major details and for lack of a better way to describe it, I would almost say that Snowblind's being pushed more in the direction of Frozen. Because it was really strange, because I just watched it the other night for the first time.
Yeah.
And hadn't seen it before. I'd heard about it or whatever, but had been working on Snowblind for a while and kept kind of wanting, there were certain aspects that I wasn't very happy with, and I kept kind of wanting to go in a different direction. And then I watched that, and it was like, I was like, damn, that's a horror movie, really. I mean, in every way, that was pretty horrific, and what they went through, and you have about the characters, and so yeah, it was I definitely when I saw that, I was impressed, and it made me realize I could probably push the route that I really wanted to go a little bit further than before. So you'll be getting the script real soon, let's just say that.
Awesome. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, then we'll talk and we can argue.
Awesome. Yeah, the thing how did you just I curled up in a fetal position I can't remember her name, but the blonde haired girl, the morning that she wakes up on the ski lift and her hand is frozen to the bar.
Yeah, so good.
And it peels off. Man, that scene just got to me, and even more so than the scene of the kid trying to be a play Mr. Hero and he jumps off the ski lift and breaks his legs and then he gets eaten by the wolves.
It's a great scene, though, isn't it?
It was.
The thing I loved about that scene is I loved the way it was handled. Like, I loved the fact that he held on those characters on the ski lift, and, like, I liked, just the little subtle things, like the way, the one best friend was telling her, like, don't look at it, and she tucked her head. It was just subtle things like that that I thought, it was just really well done, and we didn't need to watch wolves, tear this guy apart in some new horrific fashion that maybe we've never seen before. Like, maybe there's a new close up of a bone they can do or something.
Right. We heard it, and so we knew we knew what was going on.
Yeah, and you're watching these people, and you're thinking what they're thinking. Going, I mean, this is her boyfriend, and this is this guy's best friend, and imagine that happening to your buddy beneath you, and you can hear him screaming, and there's nothing you can do. It's really...
Yep.
But, yeah.
Anything
seems like a compassionate filmmaker.
What's that?
Seems like a compassionate filmmaker with the way he made that film. Yeah, in a weird way.
Yeah, yeah. Anything else you've seen recently that you dig?
Oh, man. Not too much like, you know, I had a run with some indie stuff. You know, like, I know we had talked about, like, House of the Devil and Lake Mungo.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you know, I've just caught, like, like, True Grit type stuff. I watched Restrepo, the documentary that's up for Academy Award, which is awesome.
I haven't caught Restrepo yet. I've been meaning to catch that and Exit Through the Gift Shop.
Yeah, I watched both of them. Exit Through the Gift Shop is really good. I mean, compared, though, to, like, a bad guy, Restrepo is really, really good. Really good. But yeah, I saw, and then went to Black Swan, and...
I saw that. I wanted to ask you about that, actually. So I'm glad, yeah. I'm glad that you brought that up, because I think you had a really impassioned response to that film. So you thought, so...
I'm in the minority.
I know. So explain to me a little bit. So I think your biggest thing that you leveled, if correct me if I'm wrong...
Mm-hmm.
Was that you said that the film was a little too heavy-handed.
Yeah, I just thought it was, two things. Yeah, extremely heavy-handed, and I knew exactly what was going to happen outside of one event, which I'm not, you know, I don't know if I should say, I don't know.
Oh, come on, this isn't a family show.
Okay.
It's all right.
Well, no, but with the film.
The what? I'm sorry. You broke up.
I didn't know. I don't know if I want to give anything away with the ending of the film or not.
Oh, I got you. Okay.
Anyway, how about that? Spoiler alert! Everyone, take a time out. But okay, so at the end, when she kills.
Yeah.
Okay, so I didn't necessarily see that specifically coming, but.
Okay.
But like the eventual transformation, as we could say, even if it was mental, what have you, that transformation, it was, I don't know, I guess it was, for me, it was, I didn't know, God, man, it was, you know, like I said, part of it was, you know, the beginning of the film, I was into it, and there were parts of me that were like, I don't know, and then there was a couple scenes where people in the theater started laughing, and then immediately... Their laughter, like...
Wait, did they were they laughing because of the sexual scenes, or...
No, you know when the Black Swan, you know, the leg busts and falls?
Yeah.
Its head? People just, they were laughing because it was...
Really?
Like, yeah, because everyone was just like, this is absurd.
that scene actually got to me. I was like, holy shit.
And it would have gotten to me if these bastards hadn't laughed, I think. You know, like I was into it, but I was teetering on the fence, and then their laughter, like, was the shove.
The funniest thing, so I actually went with both of my parents.
I saw that. I was...
So my dad, the first scene where Natalie Portman starts, like, getting down with herself.
Yeah.
Like, my dad starts laughing. It was hysterical, and I started laughing, too, and then I feel awkward because I'm like, my mom's on the opposite side. I'm like, wow, yeah.
Did you know that scene was coming?
I heard about the other scene between Natalie Portman and Mila Kunis, but I didn't know about the multiple scenes of Natalie Portman, getting down with her bad self.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, I think the thing is I love Aronofsky, and I really hold him probably up to a regard that I probably shouldn't, you know, because you shouldn't really put anybody on any kind of major pedestal, you know, we're all human.
You can't help it when somebody makes some classic films about, you know, characters and the breakdown of, you know, the human and the human soul. Like, it's
yeah. It's kind of good cinematically, you know. He's one of the rare, you know, people working right now that really has a great sense of cinema. And I think what it was really at the end of the day, it was the feeling of the heavy-handedness where, you know, within 5 minutes of the movie, I was kind of going to myself, all right, dude, if you show another reflection or, like, you know, the idea of split personality.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of like, I get the motif, you know, but it was like, I don't know. But, you know, it's minor, and it was probably the assholes who were laughing.
Yeah, you know, I see your point, though, you know, about the multiple reflections and then, you know, kind of that one defining moment at the end of there where she comes, I guess, face to face with the side of her that she knows she needs to get rid of, right? To become that alter ego.
Yeah.
You bring up a decent point, though, because there's a lot of films recently where I feel like have been ruined in the theater by the fact that they have to over-explain everything. They have to beat over the viewer over the head with the fact that, like, this is actually happening, you know? Do you get it? Do you understand, you know? Without leaving it up to the viewer to figure it out for themselves. I think the perfect example for that for me, and I know a lot of other people have been pleasantly surprised by it because his vast majority of his output over the last few years has been crap, is M. Night Shyamalan's Devil.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was way too heavy-handed in its religiousness, and I didn't need that to understand that the devil had manifested itself on Earth and was out to expose these people for who they were.
Yeah.
But there were just multiple, like, expositions about religion and Bible verses and passages and stuff. Not only a book ended on the beginning and the end of the film, but you know, this security guard in the middle of it is very religious, and he happens to be Hispanic. Let's stereotypes regardless, but, you know, he starts...
Is he Catholic?
Yeah. Ay, Dios mío! So he there's, like, this scene in the middle where, like, it was ridiculous because he watches security footage and he sees what happens within the stuck elevator, and he sees that, you know, Satan's there and he's doing his business.
Yeah.
And he immediately arrives to the fact that it's Satan, you know, and that's going to be the only explanation. And then he goes in this long diatribe, you know, quoting Bible verses, and Satan's here on Earth, and he does this every now and then, and he manifests himself in the body of a normal human being to exact vengeance and make people realize their wrongdoings and all this BS. And, like, it completely took me out of the experience of the film after that happened. It's like, all right, I get it. Why can't it just be a simple fact that, you know, Satan's down here and he's here to make people realize, like, they've done bad things, and that's it. And, like, it's just this brutal and relentless film, because there actually was some really brutal scenes in that film. But then it just becomes this kind of watered-down thing when it's just over-explained everything, and it just, like I said, it just completely took me out of the film.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, that's one of the, you know, obviously, you know, we know M. Night didn't, you know, technically, I guess, direct it or whatever, but, I mean, being that he, you know, definitely had his hand in it, it's like his story idea and whatnot, and that's been one of his biggest downfalls, because I'll be the first to to really go out of my way and praise a lot of M. Night Shyamalan, but I'm also going to be the first to be like, man, that's like four just crap movies in a row, you know, that he specifically made. I mean, just for me personally, where it was just, I couldn't even get through them, you know. But, you know, Unbreakable and The Sixth Sense, I just loved. And Signs especially, honestly, you get rid of the ending, you get rid of the Joaquin Phoenix beating up the alien.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty much sold on that movie being an absolute masterpiece. If he could have figured out a way to get out of that movie without having to have that happen, it would have been, I just thought it would have been phenomenal. I love the family. I love the dynamics. I love the characters.
Yeah.
It was shot. I like that they don't see it. I like the way that the different people are reacting and panicking. It's just, I thought it was just so well done. And then now it's just gotten worse and worse, where this over explanation you know, of every film to the point where, I mean, I couldn't, I don't know, I don't think I've sat through one of his films since The Village now. I can't make it through one of them.
Yeah, that was the last one I saw The Happening. I think I made it halfway through that film.
Oh, my God. What a great trailer.
The funny thing about that, I read recently online that they actually have started a, like, midnight showing of that as more of, like, just more of a mockery of kind of like a ridiculous other, I mean, not a serious film in the least bit, but just kind of like a, you know, more of like a B-movie schlock fest more than anything else.
Yeah, and that's what M. Night was trying to sell it as after it first came out. He was like, this is basically just a big-budget B-movie.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, that was like a lot of the, you never heard it before, but all of a sudden there was a lot of talk of it once it got released, and I don't know if that...
Because I remember specifically watching all those trailers and going, oh, wow, this looks pretty intense.
But exactly, that's what I'm saying. The way it was marketed was very different than the top. And yeah, man, I just remember seeing the trailer and thinking to myself, my God, this guy's, like, this movie is everything I want to do in a horror movie. Like, ultimately... some shit's happening and no one knows what's going on.
Right.
And they're just killing themselves and they're killing each other. And it's like, this is pure madness. And then all of a sudden, you know, you got a scientist with a mathematician. It's like, what are the odds of this?
You know?
Why do they always do that in movies? Why do they always have it where it's like the one person who knows, like, you know, how to do it. Like, well, I know about plants and,
and I'm Marky Mark, and you should trust me. I'm smart.
Yeah, he's anyway.
It's the worst casting ever for like a...
It really was. And then that relationship, whatever was going on, and then the reveal. Do you remember the reveal at the end? Watch it, did you? You didn't finish it.
Probably not. Yeah, I don't think so. What happened at the reveal?
I jumped to the end the next day just so I could figure out what was going on with the relationship between Mark Wahlberg and his wife Zoe. It was Zoe Deschanel, right?
Yeah.
And then because like Zoe Deschanel and her and what the hell's his name? John Leguizamo's character, like something was going on. Like I was thinking like maybe they had an affair or something weird's going on. And then at the end of the movie, you find out. She went and had coffee with him or something. I'm wrong on this, but it's something as minuscule as that. Like, they had coffee one day together, and she just never told Mark Wahlberg. I'm like, what? Is that the extent of your conflicts?
Wow.
That's crazy.
Wow.
You just got to watch it again and get to the end so you can see it, just to find out exactly what it is. It's crazy.
On a drunken night.
And, yeah, exactly. Yeah, when you got a really good buzz going and through it.
So, is there anything like in particular this year that you're jazzed about seeing, mainstream wise?
Man, I'm terrible. You know, like I'll go out for like 3 months and not know anything that's going on, and then all of a sudden I'll go and look at tons of trailers, and Unfortunately I'm in the midst of that three-month run where I don't know what's even coming out.
Did you watch the Super Bowl?
Oh, man, I worked.
What?
Yeah, I worked that night.
Have you seen the trailer for Captain America?
No, I haven't seen the Captain... Any of the, like, blockbusters like Captain America or Thor or anything like that, I haven't seen.
Thor looks kind of weird. Like, I'm a comic book geek out here for a minute because I'm also a big comic book nerd.
Yeah. That's cool.
Thor never struck me. Like, I've never liked him. Like, it's just, how can you be on the Avengers and be a god at the same time? Like, it just, I had a huge disconnect with the Avengers because of that point.
Yeah, I've never really, you know, it's like Aquaman. You know, I don't know how you make him. You know, it just doesn't work.
So I watched the trailer, and with Natalie Portman, she just looked really awkward. It's just...
Oh, she's in it?
Yeah. Yeah, she plays like the, I guess she's the love interest, but I mean, like, she also is like the person that, I don't know, discovers him when he lands on Earth.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, and there's just this really one weird clip in the trailer where she's, like, driving him in a truck. I mean, it's Thor. He flies in the air with his hammer. Why are you driving a truck? I don't get it.
How does he fly anyway? Just those wings, right?
That's another thing I've never figured out. Is it the power of the hammer that's making him fly through the air, or is it those little wings on his helmet? I don't know.
I mean, if the wings on his helmet make him fly, that's one hell of a helmet.
Yeah, that I've never figured out. But the one that I thought looked pretty cool was the Captain America trailer, like, with Chris Evans, who played Johnny Storm in the Fantastic Four films, which were crap.
Yeah, those were bad.
But, like, he's kind of like the snarky attitude about him in a lot of his other films, and, like, I think he could do Cap some justice and maybe bring a little bit more edge to him. It looked really interesting. Like, and definitely the aesthetics were there. So they're setting it back in, you know, 1940s with during World War II time. So Red Skull is going to be his main antagonist there.
Oh, see, that's cool. I like that they're setting it that time period.
Yeah. So I think that's like the first part of it, and then it flows into the Avengers film.
I'll check it out. I should probably watch some trailers anyway, just to see what's going on.
Yeah, there's some. Actually, you know what? This year, I'm actually surprised. There's not as many remakes. There's more original horror and mainstream productions coming out.
Good.
Than there has been in the past. So I'm actually a little bit more optimistic this year, mainstream wise.
Well, hopefully they learn their lesson from the remakes.
I hope so, man.
They pretty much bombed. I mean, you know, this is the one thing I've never understood about the remake aspect of a horror film is that, like, when Nightmare on Elm Street came out, like, Freddy Krueger and the whole idea of the series or whatever became a pop culture phenomenon and affected, you know, a whole group of kids and or any kid who got old enough could watch Nightmare on Elm Street and knew who Freddy Krueger was.
Right.
So when they try to reboot him, what they fail to understand, I think, is that Freddy Krueger's already in the pop culture consciousness.
Right.
You know, like, that's why Saw succeeded so well, in essence, compared to even, like, the remakes, is because they did create in Jigsaw, like, a kind of a newer pop culture thing, like a Leatherface or whatever.
Exactly.
And I don't know, with these remakes, it's like, you know, Jason's, we know Jason. Jason's not a big deal anymore. You're not going to make 16-year-old kids be freaked out about, like, a new version of Jason because, you know, the film has some modern stars. It's a pop culture frenzy, and they fail to, like, understand that, I think.
Yeah, and I can't figure that out either. Like, yeah, they number one, they can't figure that out. Number two, they continue to, like, throw lots of money at projects like this. But then when you watch it, like, they just completely, like, disregard what made those films great to begin with.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, well done movies. Even Friday the 13th is bad, realistically.
Oh yeah, the first one is. You know what? The first one's terrible. Actually.
Yeah.
My favorite of the series is the final chapter.
Is that four?
That's four with
Corey Feldman.
Yes, and the two scenes of note. You know, of course, Jason gets the machete through the eyeball there at the end. A brilliant scene in my mind.
Big time.
I love that one. And then you have Crispin Glover's freak out dance scene.
Oh, yeah.
Which was just weird and bizarre in and of itself. But hilarious.
Totally bizarre.
That to me is the quintessential slasher film of the 80s, because you had the sex, you had the gore, you had the corny dialogue, and, like, these just random scenes, and I'm like, who thinks up this shit? Like, I mean, it's just ridiculous. Like, I have a theory that the whole of the 80s, for the most part, like, most of the directors were sniffing coke and just coming up with random scenes and bits of dialogue and
oh, was that, wow, did you hear that buzz?
Yeah, was that you? And now my dog's going crazy.
No, it is me. It's my wife. I have to let her in the front door.
We have to take a time out.
All right, cool. Hey, Greg?
Hey there.
I'm back.
Live broadcasting, folks. Awesome. My dog was Ozzy was flipping out. By the way, he was like, he went downstairs to go to the front door, and now he comes back and he looks at me like, "What the fuck, Dad?"
Yeah, you're the doorbell.
Yeah, he's a very good watchdog like that.
That is good.
It's pretty funny.
It's good to know the connections going through like that too. You know.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so anyway, where the hell were we?
We were talking about Remix and how crappy and uninventive and don't add anything new to the mix.
No, they don't.
Actually, you know what? I will say this, and I've gotten a crap for this, for saying this before, but I actually liked the Last House on the Left remake.
That's one of the only ones I didn't see. I saw the Crazies.
Oh, really?
Ones. Yeah.
What'd you think of the Crazies?
You know, it's another one of those, it's another thing where it's like, I like the concept and, you know, as an example, the opening of the movie, right?
Yeah.
If they just would have opened the movie with that, with the baseball game, and all of a sudden this dude wanders out onto the field and then shoots, you know, I mean, like, that whole scene would have been great, but then all of a sudden they have that, like I'm watching fucking, what's that Will Smith movie with Gene Hackman, Tony Scott did it, you know, Enemy of the State, like,
yeah, yeah.
It's like there's these, you know, satellites shooting in, it was too much, you know, and then the casting, really, like, those guys couldn't have possibly been sheriffs, could they have?
Really? I like Timothy Oliphant. I think Timothy Oliphant's becoming a pretty decent genre star.
I like the actors. Like, I like the actual performers.
You just didn't buy him as a sheriff.
Yeah, I just couldn't. I couldn't buy them. But overall, like, as a concept and as an idea, and the film actually, I mean, had a lot of sequences that were really well executed. So I actually wasn't that, like, disappointed with that movie.
Yeah.
In comparison, but I think it's also because it didn't have the same nostalgia as, like, you know, Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street and that kind of thing.
Exactly, and that's what I think that's what lends itself to being an effective remake is the fact that there's not that hardcore fan base there. You know, it's not the sacred cow. You know, and I actually enjoyed the Crazies remake. I thought it was better than the Romero original. Because of the fact that I thought there was more character development there.
There was, yeah, absolutely.
And that's why I also like the Last House on the Left remake a lot better. Because of the same reason, and that there was also a genuine build of tension and suspense there as well. Like the first Last House on the Left, it was raw and it was gritty and it was nasty in parts, but there wasn't really any buildup or lead into. And the thing that I liked about the remake was when there was that buildup and that atmosphere, it really made it felt like it was much more justified when the parents went in there and actually killed the kids. You know, it made for a much more brutal and realistic film experience, and then like I said, like, you just, like, yeah, those kids had it coming, you know, when you got to that point.
Yeah. Have you ever seen The Virgin Spring by Bergman?
No, you know, my other cohort and partner in crime on the blog, he reviewed it a while back, and I've been meaning to because I've heard so many similarities, and pretty much that's where Craven got his.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically a direct, I mean, it's a direct remake.
Yeah.
Just modernized. It's pretty interesting to go, you know, because even, you know, when you look at the cover art of Bergman's version of the film and Max von Sydow, he's got his hands open and he's kind of staring at his hands, like coming to terms with, you know, what he's done in terms of committing murder. And you know, with Bergman, of course, you know, he's really pushing the whole spirituality and morality thing. But it's interesting to see what, like, Craven did with it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely on my short list of films. Like, I've never, you know, you've got those films that you've always wanted to see, you've never seen before.
Oh yeah.
That's one of them for me.
Well, Bergman too. You know, you got to be in the right. You know, he's a tough one. He's brilliant, I think, but he's tough.
Yeah. Yep.
So yeah. But anything else you want to cover?
Anyway, yeah, I think that's about all I had, really. It was great talking to you. You know, I hope for the best with Dawning, and I can't wait to read the day that you've inked that deal, and you know, I'll continue to do my small part and talking about it till I'm blue in the face.
Well, yeah, man. I've told you personally, obviously, I can't thank you enough for the support, obviously, that you've given the film, and
absolutely
just the fact you dig it so much and everything. It's been very kind of humbling just to have, I know you and a few other people who've kind of championed it so much. It's been great.
Awesome, man. Well, with that, I'm going to sign off, and thanks everybody for listening, and until next time, I'll catch you on the flip side.
All right, see you, man.
Thanks, Craig.
Yeah, thank you.
You're not a demon, are you?
You're tricking me!
Are they slow moving, Jake?
Yeah, they're dead. They're...